The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, and by the way, Merry Christmas, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, as we are in the first of our two major holidays, Christmas and, of course, New Year's coming up, let's explore events and places that relate to the holiday. First, we're going to hear about a church destroyed on 9/11 reopens at a New York site. Now, this story is written by Karen Matthews of the Associated Press. It appeared in the December 8, 2022 issue of the online edition of the News and Observer. It includes a photo taken by Associated Press photographer Seth Winnick, and it carries this caption: Father Andreas Vitalukas participates in a service at St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church in New York Tuesday. That would have been December 6th. The rebuilt St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and National Shrine, designed by architect Santiago Calatrava, now overlooks the Trade Center Memorial Pools. Let's see what Karen is going to tell us. Dateline, New York. More than two decades after a tiny Greek Orthodox church in Lower Manhattan was destroyed by the falling South Tower of the World Trade Center, that church's far grander replacement opened to the public this week, and again the week of December 6th, in an elevated park overlooking the rebuilt Trade Center's Memorial Plaza. The new St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and National Shrine hosted its first liturgy service on Tuesday to mark the Feast of St. Nicholas and is preparing to welcome visitors of all faiths who want to remember the victims of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Today is a joyous day for America and for New York, said Michael Saras, chair of Friends of St. Nicholas, the group tasked with raising funds for the church. We invite all of America to please come visit. To come to the cenotaph, for that was so created, that was created and built in memory of 3,000 people who were martyred and murdered on September 11. Completion of the project, one of the last pieces of the newly built World Trade Center complex, once seemed in doubt. The Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which owns the World Trade Center, battled in court over where the new church would be built before agreeing to Liberty Park, just south of the main Trade Center site. A ceremonial groundbreaking was held in 2014, but construction came to a halt in 2017 when the Archdiocese fell behind on payments. Work resumed in 2020 with the goal of opening St. Nicholas in time for the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2021. The goal was not quite met, though the church was ceremonially lighted to mark the anniversary last year. But on Tuesday, icons depicting heroes of September 11th, as well as Christ and the saints, watched over a service conducted largely in New Testament Greek. This is the resurrection of St. Nicholas Church, said Olga Pavlakos, the vice president of the parish council and a third-generation member of the St. Nicholas community. Another worshiper from a family that attended the old St. Nicholas, Maria Yatrikas, said she had tears in her eyes when she went inside the new church. To see it up like this, to see it so close to the Statue of Liberty, which represents all the immigrants who helped make this church, is a very moving to all of us, Yatrikas said. The church where Greek immigrants gathered a century ago was a converted tavern that was eventually dwarfed by the office buildings that grew around it. The new church was designed by Spanish-born architect Santiago Calatrava in the style of historic Byzantine structures, including the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, with a central dome flanked by towers. The church is covered in marble from the same Pentelic vein in Greece where the Parthenon stones were quarried, and at night its dome, through the translucent marble panels, shines like a beacon. The iconography inside was painted by a monk from Zephantos Monastery in Mount Athos, Greece, known as Father Lucas. The Reverend Alexander Kalaloutas, the former vicar general of the Archdiocese and a key player in the rebuilding of the church from the beginning, said Father Lucas was asked not just to create traditional icons, but to show the reality of September 11th. In one panel depicting the day of the attacks, boats sail to rescue people fleeing the destruction as the Twin Towers burn. In another, Christ greets first responders, including police officers and firefighters, at the resurrection. This is the first icon you will ever see in the Orthodox tradition that includes contemporary scenes for the resurrection, Kalaloutas said. We will never done that before in any Orthodox church in the world. Well, our next stop is going to be California, where Pam Cragen of the San Diego Union-Tribune reveals it's a big world after all at Disneyland Resort this holiday season. Now, her story appeared in the December 4th, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. Dateline San Diego. Since Disneyland Park opened in Anaheim in 1955, the Walt Disney Company has opened 11 more theme parks around the world, including locations in France, Japan, Hong Kong, and China. Over the past 66 years, the company has transformed from a nostalgic Americana-inspired film company and destination to be the number one entertainment brand in the world. So when it comes to hosting the theme park's annual holiday celebration, which kicked off in mid-November at the Disneyland and Disney California Adventure Parks in Anaheim, Disney now pays homage to a diversity of cultural traditions. Through January 8th, visitors can now experience music, dance, live entertainment, parades, food, drinks, and merchandise that are associated with Christmas. The Mexican-Spanish celebration of Navidad, the 8-day Jewish festival of Hanukkah, the African-American tradition of Kwanzaa, the Indian festival of lights known as Diwali, and the Latin American tradition of Three Kings Day. And that's not all. In late January, Disneyland Resort will host its annual Lunar New Year Festival, celebrating Chinese, Vietnamese, and Korean traditions. Here's a look at the diverse happenings at the two Southern California theme parks this holiday season. Parades and holiday shows starts the segment. At Disneyland, the old-fashioned Christmas fantasy parade, led by Marching Tin Soldiers, plays at 3:30 and 6:30 p.m. daily, and Disneyland's Believe in Holiday Magic fireworks, music projections, and snow spectacular is presented nightly on Main Street at 9:30 p.m. through January 8th. Also now available are the popular Nightmare Before Christmas holiday overlay on the Haunted Mansion ride and the 25th annual holiday version of It's a Small World ride. Santa Claus meets with young park visitors daily in Disneyland's Critter Country. At Disney California Adventure, the World of Color Season of Light, Water, Light, Music, and Projection show at the Pixar Pier Pond takes place at 9:15 and 10:15 p.m. nightly. And all day at the Paradise Gardens area of the park, the Viva Navidad celebration continues with live mariachi music and ballet folklorico dancing. Arts and craft stations, and meet-and-greet sessions with the Colombian character Mirabel from the animated film Encanto. Now, Santa Claus has also set up his workshop at DCA's Redwood Creek Challenge Trail. DCA is also hosting live music and dance daily with a diverse lineup of acts. Performers include the Grammy-winning Mariachi Divas, the Salsa Cumbia Latin Rock Band Tina, and the Sounds of the Celebration, the a cappella R&B ensemble The Mistletoes, who will perform Christmas and Kwanzaa music, the Klezmer Jazz Ensemble, mostly kosher, and the Indian dance group Blue 13 and the Fat Cat Swinger Big Man. How about some festive foods marketplace, which is the next part of this article? The popular festive foods marketplace food booth experience at Disney California Adventure has returned through January 8th, with 9 booths along the park's main walkway serving holiday sweets and international foods and drinks. Park visitors can buy the items a la carte or purchase a sip and savor pass that includes 8 plastic tickets for their choice of any festival items at the booths or participating restaurants in the park. With dozens of items to choose from, we polled park employees and food bloggers who got a preview of the food earlier this month for their favorite new and returning dishes. Their picks included the non-alcoholic guava melon lassi drink, the curry mac and cheese with cilantro oil and crispy garbanzo beans, and the lox and everything bagel nachos at the Twist on Tradition booth. The Impossible Carrizo queso fundido tortilla chips and nacho style cheese dip and vegan taco meat crumbles at the Brews and Bites booth. The Indian inspired Ceylon splash non-alcoholic drink at the Holiday Duets booth. The chicken tikka masala at the Favorite Things booth, the gingerbread Mickey cookie at the Making Spirits Bright booth, and the ham slider sandwich and tiramisu Yule log cocktail at the Winter Sliderland booth. While the festive foods marketplace is only in Disney California Adventure, Disneyland has also introduced dozens of new holiday food items, pastries, and chilled desserts that will be served through January 8th. The best place to find a wide selection of holiday items is the Jolly Holiday Bakery Cafe on Main Street. Next, Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Although Disney's new Marvel film, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, has nothing to do with the Christmas holidays, it opened in movie theaters on November 11th, so a Wakanda-themed celebration kicked off the same day as Disney's holiday festivities in the Avengers campus of Disney California Adventure. The new Black Panther warrior character is appearing daily in the Avengers campus. For a limited time, the warrior will lead a 5:30 p.m. nightly processional from the Avengers headquarters building to the new Black Panther celebration garden next to the Guardians of the Galaxy mission, Breakout Ride. Well, the garden has festive evening lighting, a Wakanda-themed mural, and giant Black Panther mask photo spot. And let's see here. Nearby in the Hollywood backlot next to the Avengers Merchandise Superstore, there's a new Flavors of Wakanda food booth. Now, it serves African and African-American-inspired dishes, including peri-peri chicken, peanut stew, and black-eyed peas and sweet potatoes, and butterfly PT lemonade called Dawa. An alcoholic version of the Dawa is also available. Meanwhile, the Shawarma, stand in the Avengers campus, has expanded its menu with a Wakandan roasted pork wrap sandwich with garlic sauce and chamula. Park visitors arriving for the holidays can now purchase a new device that rolled out at Disney Parks on October 26. The Magic Band Plus is an Apple Watch-style accessory that syncs with your cell phone's Disneyland app. The Magic Band Plus allows hands-free park entry if your admission tickets have been scanned into the app, the lighting lane entrance check-in, and connection to Disney Photo Pass images. It also links up with additional immersive storytelling features sprinkled digitally throughout the park. The wristband also has a haptic sensors that provide pulsing, vibration, and lights during the nighttime shows, including the World of Color and the Fantasmic. The Magic Band Plus can be purchased at locations throughout the resort starting at $35 and is available in both adult and children's wristband sizes. So lots of fun at Disneyland if you're out in California. Our next story involves a special event that takes place off the coast of Chile. It's written by Maria Teresa Hernandez of the Associated Press and appeared in the December 4, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. It's a photo taken by Associated Press photographer Esteban Felix, and it carries this caption: crew members train for the Hokimai Challenge, a voyage that covers almost 300 miles across a stretch of the Pacific Ocean in Rapa Nui, a territory that is part of Chile and is better known as Easter Island, on November 24th. Rapa Nui, Chile is our dateline. The causes are worthy, the course is daunting. Almost 500 kilometers, or about 300 miles, across a stretch of the Pacific Ocean in a large canoe. It's the Hokimai Challenge, which started Saturday in Rapa Nui, a territory in the Pacific that is part of Chile and is better known as Easter Island. The event consists of a canoe voyage in which 9 Rapa Nuis, 2 Chileans, and 1 Hawaiian seek to raise awareness about the importance of women in the world, urge protection of the environment, and celebrate the union of the islands of Polynesia. The 12 athletes have been training 6 days a week since September, mid-September, preparing for a voyage that will take them from Rapa Nui to Motu Mitorohiva, another island in the mid-Pacific that belongs to Chile. It won't be easy, says Gilles Bourdais, coordinator of Hoki Mai, 3 days and three nights. Bourdais moved to Rapa Nui earlier this year, but he has lived in Polynesia for three decades, devoting much of his time to rowing. I am very grateful to the Tahitians for teaching me their culture and how to row, he said. I came from France, but they accepted me and allowed me to share this with them. Hoki Mai pursues three goals. The first is to honor canoeing in Polynesia, which has been practiced for centuries. The second relates to the environment. Motu Mitorohiva, also called Salisi Gomez, is an uninhabited island, but its land and surrounding waters have been affected by pollution. The third purpose relates to gender equality. The team will carry a small female moai, one of the ancient statues that Easter Island is famous for, to raise awareness about the importance of women in the world. A bigger statue, carved by a local artisan for Hoki Mai, will be taken for Motu Mitorohiva in March. During the voyage, rowing will be done in relays. Groups of six will row for about 4 hours, then be replaced by the next shift. Those who need to rest will do so in a Chilean Navy ship escorting the canoe. The training has been hard, especially for those of us who are less experienced, said Kontirai Alin, a 36-year-old historian. Etienne said a crew member invited him to join a few months ago while he was out paddling a one-person canoe, and he told me, "I need you to come on Tuesdays and Thursdays to help us. We're lacking enough people to train," said Etienne, who rowed with them, shared a meal, then said yes to joining the challenge. On training days, they often started before dawn to get accustomed to the darkness they will face during much of the Hoki Mai. We practice rowing at night. We practice getting little sleep. We practice training every day. Gym rowing, gym rowing, gym rowing, except for Sunday when we rest, Attend said. Spirituality and sacredness are pervasive in Rapa Nui, including with cooking rituals and songs about their history. Now, sports also incorporates spirituality. Several days before the trip, the canoe built for Hoki Mai was blessed with a umu, which involves cooking underground with hot stones in a sacred ceremony. "We did it with a white chicken," Natan said. "It is something spiritual. Eating a piece is connecting to our roots." This cultural legacy is also linked to the moai, like the one they'll carry with them to Motu Mitorohiva. The moai are perhaps the most recognizable symbols of Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, as it's once known. Carved in a volcanic stone between 1000 and 1600 AD from the slopes of the Ranuraku volcano, they represent the ancestors of the various clans whose descendants still inhabit Rapa Nui. They were placed on ceremonial platforms called ahus, with their torsos facing the island to provide protection. They attracted international attention in October after a fire damaged dozens of them. Ahus were built in some other places in Polynesia, but moais are exclusive to Rapa Nui. The bond between neighboring islands is still strong. Rapa Nui, Tahiti, Hawaii, and even New Zealand share language similarities and other features. Now, with Hoki Mai, there's also an expectation that those ties expand beyond Polynesia. That's why the Rapa Nui and the Hawaiian will row with two continental Chileans, as the locals identify those who come from the Chilean mainland and South America. The idea of the canoe is also union, says Gilles Bourdais. Six people doing the same thing to go forward, the union of cultures. That is why people from Chile are going to row, to show that together we can move towards a better future. Well, in your travel experience, has anyone ever told you you can't get there from here? Well, people seeking to fly sometimes feel that's the case when they discover there's no direct flight, or they'll face a lot of layovers, maybe at several airports, before they complete their trip. Dubuque, we don't fly there anymore. Airlines say goodbye to regional airports is kind of that theme, It's an article that explores the fast-changing options offered many would-be flyers, and we're going to journey through the latter part of the pandemic era with this issue. It's written by Julie Weed, and it appeared in the November 23, 2022 issue of the New York Times. First, we're going to take a glance at a couple of photo captions that accompany our article. The first one, small market airports have borne the brunt of scheduled cutbacks, with some losing commercial service entirely. This has travelers facing steeper fares and convenient routes or long drives to bigger terminals. Our second caption, in September, American Airlines stopped flying to MacArthur Airport in Islip, New York, part of the continued deterioration of service in the country's smaller airports. So let's see what Julie Weed is going to tell us in her article, again written and appearing in the Times, November 23, 2022. Callista Wessels, a college senior in Ithaca, New York, has been used to flying home to Seattle from the small airport in her university town. But flights in and out of Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport dropped to about 3,000 this year from 6,000 in 2019, according to data from Cirium, an aviation analytics firm, and prices have gone up so much that sometimes she takes a four-hour bus ride to New York City to take advantage of airfares that are hundreds of dollars cheaper. There is definitely more of a barrier to getting home, she said. An unexpected hangover of the pandemic has been the withered flight schedules at many regional airports. Of the 430 airports in the continental United States and Hawaii that offered commercial passenger service before the pandemic, 76% had fewer flights scheduled in 2022 than in 2019, according to the Regional Airline Association. Smaller airports lost a dramatically higher percentage of their flights than larger airports, Fame Malarkey Black, chief executive of the association, wrote in an email. Those airports lost an average of 34% of their flight traffic, while larger airport schedules shrank an average of 16%. This September, American Airlines ceased flying to Ithaca and Islip, New York, MacArthur Airport in New York, as well as Toledo, Ohio, and Dubuque, Iowa, bringing the total number of airports where it has canceled service to 15. The airline says it has 100 regional jets parked because of a lack of pilots. United Airlines is flying, or rather ending flights to Lewisburg, West Virginia, Clarksburg, West Virginia, Weyers Cave, Virginia, and West Paducah, Kentucky this fall. Delta has not returned to 10 of the airports it left in May of 2020, including Flint, Michigan, and Lincoln, Nebraska. For travelers who live near small market airports, that can mean not only higher fares, but also inconvenient and infrequent scheduling. Hours added to trips as they need to make new connections or long drives to bigger airports that still have service. Linda Brown, 74, a consultant who flies from the airport near her home in Missoula, Montana, which has lost almost 20% of its commercial flights, according to Cirium, has been frustrated by the situation. The schedule keeps changing, she says. What airlines are flying to what towns and what time of year? They'll add a flight, and we're like, is this summer flight over? Is this forever? The prices have been frustrating, too. Recently, when she saw that a one-hour flight from Missoula to Seattle cost $567 one way, Ms. Brown thought it must be for two tickets, but it wasn't. For longer trips, she checks back multiple times to see if the price has gone down and considers if she's willing to endure two stops or ridiculous layovers. We love to travel, but this has had a chilling effect, she said. Changing route economics. Domestic passenger travel demand has come roaring back, but route economics have changed and disproportionately affect regional flights, said Brett Catlin, vice president of Network and Alliances at Alaska Airlines. The pilot shortage that arose during the pandemic has boosted salaries, especially among regional carrier pilots, he said, making those flights more expensive to run. Smaller planes are also less efficient. A 500-mile flight in a regional jet that holds an average of 76 passengers uses about 30% more fuel per passenger than the typical mainline jet, which carries an average of 159 passengers, said Mr. Catlin. This leaves airlines choosing to keep their most profitable routes. Why fly a 50-seat plane into a small town when you can deploy those same resources such as pilots, flight attendants, and a ground crew for a plane that carries three times more passengers and earns more revenue, said Jim Hetzel, director of product marketing at Cirium. At some regional airports, airlines are keeping their footprint but reducing its size. Alaska Airlines cut flights to Walla Walla, Washington to one per day from three. The current midday departure gets passengers into the Seattle hub too late to make some connections they used to be able to catch. Airline representatives recently visited Walla Walla to meet with businesses and flyers to understand their schedule needs better. Some like the early departure, others like the midday, said Mr. Catlin. So while the airline doesn't plan to add additional flights, we may change the schedule to fly at different times on different days, he said. The situation is likely to worsen over the next couple of years, said Brad DeFurry, a managing director at Elevon, Pacific Aviation Consulting, which helps airlines and airports analyze routes and other businesses' operations. In an email, smaller companies are just now starting to realize what is coming down the road, he wrote. The flight reductions are eroding passengers' ability to connect to other places, wrote Ms. Black of the Regional Airline Association. Fewer flights mean less competition, and that can translate to higher fares, said Gregory Sampson, general manager of CheapAir.com, a ticket-buying website. The company found the largest price increases for airline tickets in 2022 were in smaller markets. In Ithaca, ticket prices followed the school calendar and this year are running as high as $1,349 one way from Ithaca to Seattle for winter break. It used to be less than $1,000, Ms. Wessel said. Passengers who would rather have perhaps flown from nearby regional airports in Rochester or Syracuse are finding fare increases of about 25% over last year. The rising fares run the risk of triggering a spiral where the higher ticket prices depress demand and hasten service cutbacks, said Mr. Catlin. A market may have made sense at a certain fare, he said, but if you have to raise prices, it may not make sense to fly there. Even when airports are served by multiple airlines, when you drill down into the route level, there may be only one choice, said Mr. Sampson, and offered the examples of Flint. Allegiant Airlines, American, and United all fly into the airport there, but American and United fly only between Flint and Chicago. Allegiant flies to 10 destinations, and while travelers can find other choices and lower fares at larger airports, they may have to drive a few hours to do so, he said. Then there's no flights at all. The exits have left a handful of airports, like the one in Dubuque, entirely or almost entirely without commercial passenger service. The federal government's Essential Air Services program subsidizes airlines to ensure service to about 100 communities, but Dubuque is not on that list. Todd Daisy, Dubuque Regional Airport's director, said American Airlines had been varying the timing of its scheduled flights to Chicago. Its single destination from Dubuque over the past 2 years, on September 7th, the flight stopped completely. We are working hard to restore sustainable commercial traffic, he said. This month, Avelo Airlines, a new low-cost startup, announced it would run two flights a week from Dubuque and Orlando, Florida, beginning in January. In the meantime, the 100,000 people in Dubuque County need to drive 70 miles to Cedar Rapids Airport or 3 hours to Chicago O'Hare International Airport to fly anywhere else. And as one person said, time is a precious commodity. The time spent to get to an airport much farther away is a resource you can't get back. And that, my friends, includes today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be back with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler, by the way, is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, please direct them to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.